Hello, everyone. I'm Cressida Cowell, author of How to Train Your Dragon, and I'm just popping in to tell you about my new book series, Which Way to Anywhere. It's a story about four children who discover that there are alternative worlds beyond our own, and that they can travel to them with the help of a magical map and a very special gift. Of course, this leads to epic, unexpected adventures. Which Way to Anywhere and its sequel, Which Way Round the Galaxy, are both available to buy now. Happy reading!
This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello, welcome along to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. I am your friend in fascination, I guess. My name is Dan, and this is where we explore the dark depths of the universe. We turn inside out to have a look at the most weird, wonderful, and deadly things that exist. Now today, we're investigating what we use to defend our skies. Also, we'll chat to a butterfly expert about what they really do for our ecosystem. And also, she'll tell us whether moths are really that creepy at all. And our dangerous Dan is a brutal creature today, right? It's a snake that will make you bleed forever. That's on the way in a little bit. First, we're headed back in time now with our superhero pal, K Mystery, going to ancient Greece.
Chemistry and art with the Royal Society of Chemistry.
So I'm here at the British Museum with school. We're looking at art through the ages, you see. Today, we're learning about the ancient Greeks. Now, I like Greek salad and would love to go to a nice Greek beach for my holiday, but this art isn't exactly floating my boat.
Chemistry superhero to the rescue. Come on, Karina. This is brilliant.
Yeah, I know chemistry is exciting, but what's exciting about a load of boring statues and manky old pots?
You are joking, aren't you? Greek art is packed with chemistry. Wanna see? First thing you've got to understand is that Greece isn't just like one bit of land. Greece is made up of lots of islands reaching towards other countries.
Wow, loving this island. Sunny skies and blue seas.
We're on one of the southern Aegean islands 7,000 years ago. These islands are on important trade routes, and Greek artists are able to get hold of lots of useful materials to help them create colourful art and make frescoes.
Tescos?
No, frescoes. They're pictures that are painted onto wet plaster. As the plaster dries, the paint is absorbed by the plaster and chemical changes in it make the colour stick. Basically, a cool way to make a picture that really lasts. Because minerals are normally gathered from the ground, you're stuck with the colours you get from the land around you. For the Greeks, the most common colours around them were white, black, orangey-brown and yellow. However, they were also lucky enough to be able to get hold of all sorts of other colours from passing traders. Azurite and Egyptian blue for blues, hematite or iron oxide for reds, limestone for white.
Where are all the pots? The museum was full of Greek pots.
You're right! Greek art is famous for painted pots. Clay from the earth is heated, and the heat causes the molecules to become hardened. But while a lot of clay is hard enough for pots, some, well, isn't.
So where do all the pots come from?
Let's leap forward a couple of thousand years to 500 BCE and welcome to Corinth, a city-state famous for its pots. This is a time when all sorts of luxurious pots were being made and many were painted with decorations of mythical creatures and animals.
Not exactly using a lot of colours, is he, though? It's like all red and black. That's cool, I guess. I was just expecting a little more colour. How do they also last for thousands of years? I mean, they look almost exactly like they do in the museum, right?
Chemistry? During this period, two different techniques were used for vase painting. An early method was to paint figures onto the vases with liquid clay. And then when heated in a kiln, that's a special type type of oven, the clay figures would turn a glossy black.
A bit like how your food changes colour when it's cooked. Like a steak, brown on the outside but redder in the middle.
Exactly! And so another method that the Greeks used was to scratch their designs into pots to reveal the red body of the vase underneath, making the images really stand out. But it wasn't just the cooking time that made a difference to the colour. Greeks found that varying the amount of air in a kiln also affected the colour.
So the air was part of the chemical change too. What? The oxygen, right?
Exactly! Oh, come on, I've got one more thing to show you. This is pretty. It looks like a cool bathroom. I mean, there's lots of tiny tiles making a beautiful pattern of a hunt. There are animals and hunters. Whoops! Looks like they've forgotten their clothes. We're in Pella, around 300 BCE, and this tiled floor is called a mosaic.
Hey, I've heard of them. You can make them with all sorts of materials, right?
Sure can, but this is where it all started. Mosaics were invented by the ancient Greeks. Tiny pebbles and pieces of glass or clay were placed in tessellating patterns. Tessellating means they go together without any holes. But if you don't stick them together...
Man, they've gone everywhere. Dude needs some glue.
Dude needs some chemistry, you mean? The Greeks experimented and found that mixing a material called lime with volcanic ash and then wetting this substance made a type of cement. It's a chemical reaction that causes the cement to change its properties, and it's so tough that some of it has lasted to this day.
He's one cool chemist.
Like other ancient cultures, they might not have understood the exact chemical processes, but by getting to know the properties of the materials and experimenting, they managed to produce the amazing art we can still see to this day in museums. Talking of which, we better get you back.
That was so cool. But some of the things here look kind of different to the way they did back in time. Like, I'm sure the statues looked more colourful back in Pella and Corinth.
That's the effect of time, heat and light on the pigments in the paint. Scientists today have access to really powerful microscopes and can identify colours from traces of minerals found, showing us that these statues would have been much more colourful.
But the pots and frescoes are amazingly bright. Crazy when you think how old they are.
Yep, certainly is, Potty. Ooh, looks like your class is moving. Well, I better move too. Catch you later.
Bye, chemistry.
Chemistry and art with the Royal Society of Chemistry. Find out more and get hands-on with chemistry at funkidslive.com/chemistry.
You can also catch up with all our chemistry adventures for free on your phone or tablet. Get to the free Fun Kids app, download them wherever you get your podcasts from, and as always, it's funkidslive.com for a listen. Now, our special guest this week is a proper smart doctor and everything. Her name is Hayley Jones, and she's an insect expert. She'll tell us how important butterflies are in just a sec. First, it's time to spin the shout-out wheel and find out which lucky person who has left the show a review on the iTunes podcast store is getting a hello this week. Going through names, people who have left reviews, name after name. There you go, it's finally settled on Oscar. Hello, Oscar, who has given this show the official 5 iTunes stars that we need that really help the chart out there. And also, he's given us 5 bonus stars just from him in the review, which is amazing. Thank you so much, Oscar, mate. I'm so glad that you're there exploring the universe with us. Now, if you want a shout out on the show, really, that's the only way you can get it. You need to head on to the iTunes podcast store, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, press your thumb on your phone and tablet a few times, leave us a review, 5 stars would be amazing. Also, drop your name as well, so then I know that you're there. I can add your name to the shout-out wheel that's in the Fun Kids studio, and next week, who knows, I might say hello to you. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, our guest this week is Dr. Hayley Jones. She's an entomologist at the RHS Garden Wisley, and she's here to tell us all about their Butterflies in the Glasshouse event, which is happening until March. Hayley, hello.
Hello.
Firstly, feels fantastic to have a doctor on the show.
Oh, yes, but I'm not much use if you're feeling unwell.
No, I mean, that's a good point, but it sounds... I think I'm a mister. I know there was a point where you're a master, that's your title, but now I'm a mister. But doctor's way more impressive, so congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you for being here. Now, you're a doctor of biology and entomology, which is the study of moths and butterflies, right?
Yeah, so entomology is a study of insects, but my particular specialty is moths and butterflies.
So now, the first question, and I don't want it to seem too fighty, what is the point of a butterfly? Because we're always hearing about bees. They're really important for the environment and for wildlife, for the ecosystem. What about butterflies? What do they bring to the table?
Well, it's interesting that you start talking about bees, because like bees, butterflies can pollinate flowers. So they're very good at helping flowers to set their seed, and that's all part of kind of the plant life cycle. And butterflies can do that too, and moths as well, because a lot of species have a proboscis, which is kind of like a straw. So rather than having a mouth that opens and closes like ours, they have a long straw they can stick out, and they can drink the nectar, which is like the sugary liquid that's in the flowers. And while they're doing that, they pick up some of the pollen, and then when they're at another flower, they drop it off, and so they help to pollinate the plants.
So you mentioned the words life cycle there. Mm-hmm. When we talk about butterflies, we love to chat about the life cycle. Let's just lay the groundwork. And can you talk us through a butterfly from the moment they're born to the moment they die? Because I know they go through a few changes in their lives.
Yes. So you've probably heard of the very hungry caterpillar. And that's, you know, that's the basics of it down. So they start off as an egg. They hatch out into a little caterpillar. And those are just eating machines. So their aim is to just keep eating and eating. And unlike us, their skin doesn't grow with them as they grow. So they have to molt, which means their skin splits open and a bigger version pops out each time. So they do that about 5 times around their caterpillar till they're as big as they're going to get. And then they make a pupa. So they go into this kind of very still form, and inside they dissolve everything, break it all down, and then they rebuild it into a butterfly or a moth. They break out, spread out their wings, inflate them up, let them dry until they're ready and set, and then they can fly. And then once they're in that stage of their life, they can reproduce, so they can have babies, lay their own eggs, and the whole thing starts again.
And very quickly, because the thing I'm most interested in, I think you're probably the person best to answer this, is why evolutionary have butterflies evolved to start off in like a cocoon, in a pupa, and then to move out into this beautiful winged creatures? Where has this come from?
So no one can say for sure why it evolved that way, but it makes sense, because if your aim is when you're growing up simply to eat as much as possible to get all the energy you need, then if you literally existed as a tube that's only purpose was eating, you didn't have to have any other body parts that were any distraction from just eating and eating. And then you can transform yourself into your other form for your next step, which is to reproduce. So if you can do that successfully, then your genes are going to carry on. So it's like having 2 different forms which are specialised, one for eating and one for reproducing. And you don't have to have any spare parts when you're in either of those forms, just the main one that you need.
And I think one of the reasons that we love butterflies is just their striking colour. Why is that a thing, but very simply? Why are they very colourful, and what dictates what colour they're going to become?
Well, the different species will have a particular colour pattern. Some of them will have more than one form within a species, but generally, the colour itself performs a number of functions. It's to startle or deter predators. Some things might be coloured red or orange or yellow to show that they taste bad, so that a predator doesn't want to eat them. And then there's the other side, which is you want to look like what you are so that you can find mates of the same type as you to carry on and reproduce. So all those like thousands and thousands of different specific patterns you see are just a result of this one species is only reproducing with itself.
And I know that it's not just butterflies you're a genius on. Moths are a big thing for you as well. But I don't really like the moth, you know, because when I think of a butterfly, gorgeous thing flapping from flower to flower, it's sunshine. When I think of moths, I think of pesky little things that are trapped up in my clothes and stuff. What's the difference? Why and why do we think of moths so badly?
Well, that is interesting. When I first started studying moths, my mum's actually terrified of them. So she wasn't very happy to hear about this. And I've almost tried to convince her around, but not quite. But the first thing to know is that they're not actually, moths and butterflies are not actually that different. They come in the same family and there's very few biological differences between them. One of the things that we think we know is that butterflies fly in the day and moths fly in the night, but there's actually quite a lot of moths that fly in the daytime as well. So if you were walking through a flower meadow, you might disturb a cinnabar moth, which is black with bright red stripes down its wing edges. So if you saw it flitting by, you might think it was a butterfly, but it's actually a moth. Which brings me on to the second one, which is that butterflies are colourful and moths are very dull. And there are lots and lots of moths that are brown or beige, but there's also lots and lots of them that are very colourful. One of my favourites is the elephant hawk moth, which is pink and green and kind of stripy and, you know, extremely colourful and striking and, you know, you wouldn't miss it if it was flying past you. And then there's some things like their antennae. Butterfly antennae are usually straight with a little kind of club dot on the end, and moth antennae look more feathery, especially when they're males, so more frilly. But that's still not a rule that applies to everyone. You'll find some moths that have the other type and some butterflies that have the other type. So I'm trying to tell you that they're not really that different. And actually, in this country, I would argue that the moths are more important, because in the UK, we have 69 species of butterfly and we have 2,500 species of moths. So there's so much more diversity out there, different types of moths that you can find feeding on different plants. And, you know, they're really fascinating and they deserve more people's attention.
I know this sounds a really stupid question, but why aren't moths more colourful? Why are butterflies bright and striking? And why, as you say, most moths are brown, a bit grey, possibly beige? Surely that doesn't help them with trying to reproduce.
Well, if you were to look at the moths that fly in the daytime, there is a lot of colourful ones, and there are some colourful moths that fly at night, but most moths that fly at night can be beige because it doesn't make any difference. If it's dark, there's nothing to see, so they're going to have other ways of finding mates. All insects use this, but moths in particular have what's called pheromones. So the female moth will release this kind of smell, her own special perfume, and the males will use their feathery antennae to detect that, and they can find their female from really far away, and they don't need to use their eyes at all.
Now, one of the things that the event Butterflies in the Glass House is trying to do at the RHS Garden Wisley is make us more aware that butterfly numbers are in decline. That's right, isn't it? So how can we stop that? Just every day in our own back garden, what can we try and do to encourage more butterflies to be more prosperous?
So, when you're trying to think about how you can help butterflies, it's again worth thinking about the two different life stages, the adult butterflies and the caterpillars. So for the adults, you want to plant plants with flowers that have nectar, like you might have heard of Buddleia, which often has these big purple flowers, and butterflies really, like, sometimes called the butterfly bush, because butterflies like to drink the nectar from that flower. So you'll often be able to see them feeding there if you have that in your garden. On the RHS website, we have a big list of plants that you can have in your garden for that. And also you have to think about the caterpillars. This can sometimes be a bit tricky because people don't usually want caterpillars to eat the plants in their garden. But if you are happy to have an area where you let things get eaten, you let things get a bit overgrown, because nettles are a plant that lots of caterpillars like. So if you can have a little wild corner and then plant some different plants and let them grow a bit kind of denser, not have it too tidy, then you'll have a nice habitat for the caterpillars to live in, and then hopefully that means you'll be able to see the butterflies and moths as well.
Brilliant. Well, the event is Butterflies in the Glass House. It's on at the RHS Garden Wisley until March. What's the website?
rhs.org.uk.
Perfect. We'll get on there, find out loads more about the bushes you need in your garden to help out the butterflies. Dr. Hayley Jones, thank you so much for coming on.
Yes, thank you.
It's time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we talk about the most mean and deadly things in the whole universe. And actually, I really need to put a warning on today's. If you're squeamish, if your belly quivers and shivers at the sight of blood, well, be warned, there's a lot of that in this. Because the boom slang snake is a gorgeous blue or greeny black colour. And it makes you believe the phrase, never trust a pretty face, because the Bloomslang snake is pure evil. Now, it lives in Africa, and it's quite calm and peaceful. It won't go to attack humans, only bites when it's provoked. But what happens when you're bitten? It's just, like, wicked. And not in the amazing way. The Bloomslang's venom, it's hemotoxic. Now, that means it gets into your body and it attacks your blood cells and it stops them from clotting. Now, very simply, clotting is, you know when you cut yourself, right, and you bleed, but then after a while it stops and the blood dries up and it gets all sticky, stops any more blood getting out? Well, that's what happens when it clots. It's a defence mechanism, so you just can't bleed forever. And if your blood can't clot, then it can't stop. So the Bloomslang's venom means that when it pulls its fangs out of the skin, it's already injected you, you'll start to bleed and it'll run and run and run until there's nothing left. Sometimes you even start bleeding from your nose, mouth and ears. Rivers of red too. Oh, I know, I'm sorry, your belly's going, isn't it? Deadly animals, they have many different ways of trying to kill their prey, but the Bloomslang's, to my mind, it's the most mean method ever. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. We'll get one of the questions that you have sent to my page at funkidslive.com answered by our science expert, Tom, in just a sec. First, we're catching up with our other favourite science expert on the show, Professor Hallux, and he's fixing your body piece after piece, arm after arm, leg after leg, improving all of you. And today, we're having a look at your gut.
Hallux's Physiology Fix-Up.
Now, what on earth has made that nasty whiff? It smells worse in here than it did after the Renegade Science Egg Night.
Just a little sulfur. Nothing to get worked up about, Nanobot. This is my combustible compostulator. It breaks down foods into lots of lovely nutrients.
And produces some appalling aromas. Never mind compostulator. I'll see you later, if you don't get rid of that stench.
It's overpowering.
Smells are a very interesting part of the system I'm trying to improve.
Which is?
The digestive system. The digestive system is a group of organs working together to convert food into energy and basic nutrients to feed the entire body.
And you think that smelly old compost heap can do a better job?
You mean combustible compostulator? Of course it can. I mean, how hard can it be?
Very hard. Organs and systems in our bodies have a number of jobs to do, and they're able to do all these jobs because of the way they are constructed and the way they work with other parts of the body.
All right, I know. So let's put it to the test.
Loading physiology file.
Digestive system. Job 1. The glands of the digestive system make special proteins called enzymes, whose job it is to break down food into smaller pieces or building blocks.
Physiology fail.
Your invention doesn't have any enzymes, just a lot of smells.
Good point. Let's see if it passes the next test.
Digestive system job 2. The stomach holds the food and with the help of bile from the liver breaks down fats so that nutrients are released.
Well, my combustible compostulator does hold the food.
But there's no bile to break down the fats.
Physiology fail.
Better look with the next one.
Digestive system job 3. Food is absorbed by the small intestine and water by the large intestine, and the waste that is left is expelled from the body.
Well, my invention is brilliant at expelling waste. But as for the rest...
Physiology fail.
What a shame. Well, it's not that the systems and organs in our body can't be improved, but whatever they look like, they need to be able to carry out their important jobs and work with other parts of the body in the right way.
That's right. And the clever thing about physiology is that if you know what job something should do, then it makes it easier to fix things when they go wrong.
Here's an example. There's a rather nasty illness called IBS, which affects the digestive system. It can can cause people to have a lot of pain after they eat. But scientists understand the physiology of the digestive system. They're able to see that people with this condition aren't able to absorb all the nutrients from their food. This leads to diarrhea, because more food is expelled than it should be.
And if you know what's gone wrong, then you're on the right track to make it better. Talking of which, how about a new and improved type of skin?
Here we go again.
Alex's Physiology Fix-Up, with support from the Physiological Society. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Alex.
Now, every week on the show, we've got our expert, Tom, here to answer one of your science questions, right? So if you've got one, just ask it to me. Send it over to my page on the Fun Kids website. I promise, right? It doesn't matter how silly or serious it is. If it's about science, we'll take it. Maybe you want to know why the clouds hang in the air and they don't get really heavy and fall to the ground. Or, I don't know, you're just trying to figure out why some bogeys taste better than others. Whatever it is, if it's about science, if you think it needs an expert's answer, let me know. Funkidslive.com. This week's question comes from Aaron, who is 7. Particularly interesting for what I do. Why are radio waves invisible?
So radio waves are a type of electromagnetic wave, and another type of wave is visible light. So it's actually fundamentally the same thing. Where it differs is its frequency or its wavelength, because they're very related. So a radio wave has a very large wavelength, but on the other side of the spectrum, a gamma ray has a very small wavelength. Now, our human eye is only trained to see visible light, which is a small band on that spectrum. That's because of evolution, because we don't need to see radio waves. Other animals that might be a danger don't emit radio waves, but they do reflect visible light, and so that's why we see them.
So two questions I've got. Can we train ourselves to see radio waves and different waves?
Well, we use radio telescopes to look into space, but we can't still see the radio waves ourselves. What we do is we translate the data we get into our point in the spectrum, so into visible light.
And are there any animals that can see radio waves?
Sure, about radio waves. Lots of animals can see ultraviolet waves, UV light, which is a slightly higher frequency than visible light.
And why do they need to see UV? Why have they evolved that way?
Well, UV light can get through the Earth's atmosphere, so it does reflect off certain objects, which is why they need to see them.
It's time for this week's Science in the News. Astronauts, they might have to start eating their own poo. You see, researchers at the American Penn State University, they've developed a technology that breaks down solid and liquid waste, also known as poo, and transforming it into a safe and hygienic food. You see, everything is helpful up in space when you're on a tiny spaceship if it's recycled. So eating your own poo would be really useful. Apparently it's high in protein and fat, and it tastes like Marmite. I am never going to discover that, I promise. Also, staying in space, dust storms are stealing Mars's water. Hurricanes of Martian soil are whipping up a frenzy in space. They're sucking up all the water vapor that's left on Mars. Now that is a big deal if, as astronaut Tim Peake told this show, if humans are looking to go there in the future, we're going to need some water to drink. And finally, Hong Kong have voted to ban the trade in ivory, which people are saying could save the elephants. You see, elephants' tusks, they're made of ivory. It can be sold for a load of money. And many elephants are being poached and killed for their tusks. But stopping the sale means that there's fewer people to buy them, and hopefully less elephants being poached. We're checking in with Amy Aviation now on the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Amy, she's flying to places all around the country, looking at what the UK does for the aerospace industry. Now today, she's headed to Stevenage to see how we stay safe.
Amy Aviation's British Aeronautics.
There are loads of places around the UK which are associated with Britain's aerospace industry. Some of them might be near to where you live. Let's spin the propeller and see where we're headed today. It's Stevenage. Get ready for takeoff. Stevenage is a busy town in Hertfordshire, not far from London. It's home to Airbus Defence and Space, and as aviation companies go, they don't get much bigger. Airbus makes a massive variety of aircraft, using the very latest and newest technology and materials to create the most efficient craft possible. In fact, in Stevenage, they're aiming just about as high as you can get.
3, 2, 1.
Space. Scientists and engineers research, design and build things like satellites, machines which go into Earth's orbit. They undertake a wide range of jobs, from providing navigation and communication links to taking measurements of the Earth and undertaking scientific research. They also support satellite communication services with the UK Armed Forces, including mobile voice, video, internet and broadcast communications. And it's in Stevenage where Airbus scientists are helping design and test the navigation systems for the ExoMars rover that will be sent to Mars in 2018. They've even mocked up the surface of Mars in a warehouse to test the rover. I bet you didn't know all this space-age technology was so close to home. And talking of home, it's time to fly. Catch you next time.
Aviation's British Aeronautics, with support from the Royal Aeronautical Society. Find out more at funkidslive.com/Amy.
Loads of Amy Aviation episodes that you can catch up on for free. Get to the Fun Kids app on your phone or tablet, save them on there. Also, you can download them through your favourite podcast place, like iTunes, and you can always have a listen at funkidslive.com. That is it for another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. I'll just, you know, give you a minute to pick up the pieces of your brain that have scattered all along the floor from where we've blown your mind with another amazing exploration of the universe, if I do say so myself, and I do. We're back with another show next week. If you can't wait 7 days, though, you can catch up with all our brilliant science series for free from Fun Kids on the Fun Kids app, on your favourite podcast space, also at funkidslive.com. And you can tune in to Fun Kids all over the country on your DAB digital radio, on that free Fun Kids app, and we're always over at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Hello everyone, I'm Cressida Cowell, author of How to Train Your Dragon, and I'm just popping in to tell you about my new book series, Which Way to Anywhere. It's a story about four children who discover that there are alternative worlds beyond our own, and that they can travel to them with the help of a magical map and a very special gift. Of course, this leads to epic, unexpected adventures. Which Way to Anywhere and its sequel, Which Way Round the Galaxy, are both available to buy now. Happy reading!